Well, I also would like to thank you very much for coming, for your time, and also especially Mr. Alberto Mangel, as Anna already said. I hope you understand my English, yeah? No problem? My Mexican English, okay. It is a great pleasure for me to have Mr. Alberto Mangel here. It was always a dream to have him here. That's why when we were discussing, I thought first of Mr. Alberto Mangel, and finally we have him here. I just would like to say some things about his life. Probably you already know a lot about him. Yes? No? Yeah? Okay, I quickly tell you something about his interesting biography. Please correct me if I say something wrong, okay? About your biography.
I will.
So, Mr. Alberto Mangel was born in 1948 in Buenos Aires, in Argentina, the capital of Argentina. And when he was 16 years old, from 1964 till 1968, he was the reader of Mr. Jorge Luis Borges. He's a very famous Argentinian writer. He was working in a library.
A bookstore.
And he's really a citoyen du monde, a world citizen, not only because of his books, of his different genres of literary work, but also because he has lived in so many countries, in so many cities. Before the lecture, we were discussing and we were talking about the possibilities of traveling now for young people. And of course, it was different, but Mr. Alberto Mangel, he also traveled a lot because he told me, now in these days, you can, as a student, you can do an Erasmus, you can travel to this place, to that place. And so he has also traveled a lot in his time. He has lived in Canada, in Tel Aviv, in Cyprus, I think, France.
Not in Cyprus, in several European countries and in the South Pacific.
In Tahiti, right?
In Tahiti.
Nice, beautiful. So I think we can start. Now he lives in France.
In France.
And he's a Canadian citizen, mm-hmm. right? So I think we could start, and I would have the first question. And of course, please ask also questions. And if you don't understand something, please ask. So, Mr. Mangel, I was wondering, what is a library for you, actually? Because in a lot of books of yours, especially in the last ones also, and in the most famous one, you have the library and also books as the main protagonists of your books. Mm-hmm. So it's not only people, but also libraries and books. Mm-hmm. It's not very usual in literature. Can you tell us something about it?
I think my relationship to books and libraries stems from a very early experience. As you said, I was born in Buenos Aires, but immediately we started to travel because my father was in the diplomatic service. So as a child, when I was 3 or 4, and I learned to read very early on, I remember how confusing and even distressing it was to go to a different room every night and be in a bed that I didn't recognize and hear voices that I didn't understand because of the different places we traveled to. And the relief of going to my books and opening the book and seeing that on the same page was the same text and the same illustration. They hadn't moved. And this was for me a fixed place in the universe. Marguerite Yourcenar, the great French novelist, said, "Ma patrie sont les livres." My homeland is the books. And I feel that is very true. I've never believed, I've never been capable of believing in the concept of nationality. The idea that we embrace the country where we were born just because we were born there makes to me no sense. This fidelity we are made to swear to the place where our mother dropped us is to me absolutely irrational. And therefore, I believe much more strongly in a marriage of love. That is to say, you fall in love with a place, you fall in love with the people, you fall in love with the culture, you feel that that is yours, and then you become someone of that culture. And for the longest time, living in so many different places, I never found a place to which I wanted to belong. I lived in France, where you can't become French, that is an impossibility. It's like becoming Austrian, it's an impossibility. You have to have your great-great-great-great-grandfather born here, and even then, if you come from a different valley, you're a foreigner. So none of the places I lived in were mine until I arrived in Canada. And suddenly I discovered there a society that for me was the closest thing to a democracy that I had imagined. Maybe not any longer, because we have now a right-wing government that is slowly pulling everything apart. But nevertheless, at the time when I got there, this was in the late 70s, early 80s, Canada seemed to be a place in which I could be a fully fledged citizen. I could behave as a citizen. I could feel that I had a part in the say of what happened in society. So that's why I became Canadian. So now I am a Canadian born in Argentina, living in France.
Interesting. So the result of your migration, of you going to Canada to live, was it because of the dictatorship in Argentina?
Oh, no. That is very, very important. I will make no claim of the sort. I lived in Argentina from 1955, which was when Perón fell and my father was sent back to Argentina, to 1969, which was the beginning of the first military dictatorship before what was called the real military dictatorship, just because it was bloodier. So I left before it really started, and many of my friends were forced into exile, or were tortured, or were killed and disappeared. So I will only bear witness to that from outside. I will not say that I was exiled as they were. And in fact, I never felt that I was in exile. I think that exile is a state of mind. To be an exile, you have to feel that there is a place that you left, even if it's a place that you imagine, that you construct in your mind, that does not correspond to the place that exists. But you have to feel that you have left a place. I never felt I left a place. I always felt I was going somewhere. So
rather optimistic than pessimistic. You left a place, you...
Well, there is no term that is the opposite of exile, but if there were a term, something like an in-isle, you know, an exile and an in-isle, I would be an in-isle, because I was arriving somewhere. Throughout history, we have stories of migration, which, of course, being your subject, you know more than I do about this. But migration does not necessarily mean having to leave a place to go to another. Migration may be the choice of going towards a better place, finding the place. The biblical tradition of Exodus is not only that you want to leave the land where you are slaved under Pharaoh, but because you have a promised land. And even if, like Moses, you don't get to the promised land exists, and it becomes the point, the geography, the landscape that gives meaning to your movement. So I was never an exile, and I'm still not an exile, even if I travel around too much.
I like your idea about going to a place and not having a patriotic sense. Mm-hmm. But especially in these days, with a lot of migration, for example, Mexico to United States, mm-hmm. or Africans that want to come to the European Union, many people can choose where they want to go. You could choose it in mm-hmm. your life, and also through the literature, because it's like for you, the literature opens yourself, no?
Yes.
And criticizes and reflects all your construct of your life, of yourself. How do you see this?
Yeah, those are three different ways of looking at our nomadic self. Let me begin with a story. I always found it very curious that God prefers the nomadic, cattle-rearing Abel to the sedentary agricultural Cain. That when Cain offers God his harvest, God refuses it and prefers the sacrifice of cattle that Abel makes. I think that this reflects somewhere the idea that in the Judeo-Christian tradition, the nomadic people, the people who had to travel from pasture land to pasture land, were preferred to those who stayed at home. And leaving aside God's non-vegetarian preferences, I think it does reflect a real inclination to move across the world, which perhaps comes from our very early ancestors who had to move and cross continents, as we know they did. Now, in our time, these movements, as we know, are of different kinds. On the one hand, there is the free movement of you going to study in another country or my coming to speak in Austria. We are very privileged in this that we can move this way. In my youth, when I was much younger than you were, than you are, I was not that free. I had an Argentinian passport, and with an Argentinian passport, you could not travel anywhere.
It's like Mexican.
Well, it was worse than what Mexican is now, because you couldn't have a job anywhere and you needed visas for everywhere. And it was very, very hard. And what happened was that it made you feel unwanted, and it made you feel that you were guilty of something, secretly guilty of something, and that you would be punished if you tried to leave the place that was supposed to be yours. And that builds in the mind an idea of the world that is immediately divided into us and them. Even if it is not your problem or your concern, you are forced into that way of thinking. I think that this applies, of course, to those who are not as fortunate as we are now, and who don't have the choice of staying in their place, because the choice of many of the people that we call refugees or exiles is to die or to try and move somewhere else. This is the only choice. I'm not even talking about economic migration or social migration, or because they want to study, or because they want to see the world. I'm not talking about any of that. I'm talking about somebody who simply doesn't want to be killed when they stay at home, as happens to so many people today. And in those movements, there is a question that we refuse to acknowledge, and when I say we, those of us who live in privileged societies, and that is the question of how do you want us to live? Who do you want us to be? Who are we supposed to be? It is ultimately a question of identity. Because we are saying, you cannot come, but who are those that cannot come? We have to be able to give some sort of an answer. In the 70s, there were serious race riots in England. We forget with what is happening now, we forget that it happened many times before. And one of the rallying cries of the mainly Caribbean population who was protesting was, we are here because you were there. We have, as societies that became what we are through imperialism, we have the obligation of answering to our own past. And we are refusing to do that, and the consequences are going to be terrible. Because what we saw, for instance, now happening in England, is the reaction of people who are not given a choice. In England, they were saying, these young people, they have all the opportunities of a civilized society, and all they want is to loot. And no responsibility was taken for why are they looting? Why in a consumer society that constantly tells everyone, you must buy, you must have, you won't be happy unless you have a $500 jeans, you won't be a real person unless you own 6 television screens. Why that society is not acknowledging that it is simply the reaction to someone who at the same time is told that they must have and that they can't have. Out of that contradiction comes this revolt. Now, the third part of your question was the travel through literature. And this to me is the most important because literature is not a separate part of the world. Literature is an intrinsic part of the world. As a species, human beings have developed as a survival tool the power of imagination. That is to say, we are the only species that can imagine experience before having experience. I can imagine what it would be like to pour this glass of water over my head before pouring the glass of water over my head and saying, then I would prefer not to do it. This capacity of imagining reality before experiencing reality in order always to survive has led us to imagine narrations of the world, to tell ourselves what is the experience of the world before having the experience of the world. And these narrations are simple or complex. They end up being certain given stories that we retell with variations throughout our different histories. And they allow a number of things at the same time. They allow us to put words to the experience of the world. That in itself is extremely important because we don't know what an experience is until we can lend it words. We can approach the experience, we can overcome the experience, but in order to be able to reflect upon the experience, we need words. And those words are given by the stories that we tell. Furthermore, the capacity of reading, and I'm talking, of course, about literate societies because oral societies function in a different way. In literate societies, our capacity of thinking is related to our capacity of reading. Physiological studies made on the brain, and these are fairly advanced now, they're for the past 20, 30 years we have been mapping the brain. And it is such a fascinating idea that we are the only species that use part of our body to reflect on part of our body. That is to say, we use the brain to try and think what the brain is doing. It's a self-referential tool like no other. Well, in this brain, we have clusters of neurons that are highly specialized and that interact with one another, the clusters do, moving around, forming neural paths that allow us to do whatever our body does, including thinking. And physiologists who study what happens to the brain when we read, and it's fascinating because it's studied through the negative, it's studied through people who have had an accident and suddenly find that they can't read a newspaper, or that they can't read images, or that they can't read capital letters, or that it's very specific, or that they can't read italics but they can read Roman type, and so on. Studying these, you see that there are parts of the brain that are not then lit up, and you know that then those are parts of the brain that specialize in these functions and connect in specific ways. What we have discovered is that the thinking function is akin to the reading function. The neural path that we construct are similar, and they are related to other ways of apprehending the world. For instance, children, very young children who learn to read have a quicker and better facility if they are trained to listen to music. Music helps, as it were, open the path that will allow you to recognize and make sense of letters, that will help you in turn think. So it's extraordinarily important. And so when I insist on the importance of reading, and when we insist on the importance of reading, what I'm talking about is not the elitist privilege of saying I am a reader and you are not, but of saying here we have the possibility of refining the human capacity to think. Why would you refuse that? Everyone has the choice of becoming a reader or not becoming a reader. But what we have to know is that this choice is affected in the context of a society that doesn't really want you to be a reader, that doesn't really want you to think. Because if you think, you cannot be a good consumer. You know, if you go beyond reading the advertising and you attempt a reading in depth, a thought-out reading, what do you do with advertising? What do you do with drink Coca-Cola? The first question that comes up is why? It is, I think, essential for us to constantly insist on asking the questions. Advertising in commercial advertising, political advertising, advertising of any kind does not want you to ask questions. And that is why you have to constantly ask questions and turn the system on its head simply by not accepting what is being said as fact, by using your prerogative as a reader, a thinker, a human being of saying, why?
So is that what
yes, exactly. Because
and
yes,
and is it also like Jorge Luis Borges said that reading should be not always only how can I say it? Like you described it in your article, that reading is not only that you have to read from many, and not you don't have to read always the whole book, but also read. Wie sagt man's? Not in a formal way, but
Well, it's the same in two different questions. The idea of subversivity in reading, being subversive, the submersiveness of reading, is simply because we need to define reading to understand what we're talking about. There is a very vast definition of reading, which serves to speak of much more than reading letters. I said before that as a species, we are a species trained to imagine. It's our capacity. But this makes us come into the world with what I would call a narrative nerve. We tend to find narrative in everything. Even that which does not deliberately have a narrative. We look at the landscape of mountains and we see a story. It means something to us. It is happiness or tragedy depending on the weather. It's a historical narrative, it's a geographical narrative, it's a sociological narrative. We find narrative in everything. We find narrative in the expression of people. We find narrative in the sequence of time. History is our invention. As far as the cosmos is concerned, there isn't a sequence that depends on the existence of Napoleon and so on. This is something that we constantly construct and deconstruct and construct again. So when we are confronted with this act of reading within a society, the definition narrows, and it ends up meaning learning the code by which we can communicate. Every society needs a common code to share the laws, to share the rules, to share the notion of identity, the notion of history, the inclusion and the exclusion. We need to have a common code or we cannot have a society. And so every society needs to teach the elements of the code, so the alphabet, the grammar, and so on, and needs to reach a point where the most superficial and essential of social messages can be deciphered. You have to know that a stop sign means you put a stop. Otherwise, you cannot function in that society. You have to know that in is in and exit is exit. You cannot function in a society without knowing that. But beyond that, the reading that takes a text and discovers in that text the reflection of your experience, the text that will tell you what you didn't know you knew about your secret self, about your intuition of the world, about the memory of the generations that preceded you, about the dialogue that you establish with the people who are no longer there. All this the society is very afraid of. Even in Mesopotamia, when long after writing was invented, the schools of scribes would train certain men, and not women, to learn reading and writing in order to preserve the laws and the history of that society. They gave those specialized people the name of scribes. They refused to call them readers, but in fact what was more important than the fact of writing down the laws of the new king was being able to read those tablets and tell the king, these are the laws, this is what you have to follow, this belongs to you, this does not belong to you because it says so here. the power of that person who could do that was immense. With that power, with the power of reading that, I can say to you, you're not allowed to sit on that chair because it says here. And this belongs to me because it says here. These were the scribes, but they were mainly readers. And so I think that the fact that they were not given the name of readers even then reflects this ongoing fear that society has of the intellectual act, of the act of reading. And so going back to the idea of subversiveness, especially in our time, but it has happened many other times before, the person who becomes a reader, reader in depth, has the power to subvert society, has the power of saying, this is wrong, I don't agree with this, who does this benefit, this is not true, and question society. Society is defined by what it excludes. Every society has to construct rules in order to say, this is Austria and this is Turkey and it is not the same thing. And then, within the society, the individual has to constantly break those walls and bring in what that society doesn't have to go on living. Because the only society that is fixed in its identity is a dead society. It's the only way you can fix an identity. Say, this is finished, there's no more discussion, but because it's dead. So the function of the reader in a society is always subversive. The real reader.
Reading is imaginating and questioning.
It's imagining and questioning and thinking and bringing back the memory of that society and refreshing that memory to take it forward. It's all these things. Now, to that, you mentioned Borges's idea of
reading.
Yes. The reader on different levels. Well, Borges argued that the activity of reading cannot be an official one. It cannot follow the dictates of any authority, whether it's the university, whether it's the government, whether it's your parents, whether it's the taste of society. It has to be a personal choice. And because literature is so vast, you will always find your choice. It will not be the same. You may hate Flaubert, and I may hate Balzac, and it's perfectly fine. They both exist for us to love and hate and pick and choose. I'm always surprised by the fact that we think it's perfectly natural that out of the millions and millions of people in the world, there are people that we like and there are people that we don't like, and then there's one person we fall in love with, and that's perfectly normal. To you, it's perfectly normal, but from anyone else looking outside says, oh, how come he picked this person, not this other person, or so on. For a reader, it's exactly the same thing. I hate saying this in a university setting, but ultimately, every criticism boils down to I like it or I don't like it. And then we construct an edifice of theory on this. Perfectly valid. But essentially, hand on your heart, you have to say, this speaks to me or it doesn't. And you can be confident that you will find something that will speak to you. Now, I can promise you that with enough time, anyone sitting in your place will find in the library a page that was written for that person and reflects that person's deepest secrets. That I can promise you that.
Wasn't it Aristoteles that he wrote that one himself finds in one such a book always the prior like incarnation? Can you understand it?
I hope he said that because it's a nice idea.
Yeah, that he says the same because he says if you and me, for example, we go to the library, you take one book, I take the other one. But why is that? Why do you take this book? Why do I take this book? And this is because we are like searching from another life, he was saying. So
oh, we're searching from this life here. You know, from this present, from this here and now, we search for those incarnations of ourselves. I like the idea that that Aristoteles might have said this. I don't remember this quotation, but Seneca said more or less the same. He said, we can choose our ancestors. We can look at the library and say, Plato or Sophocles or Cicero or whoever else, these are my ancestors. This is my family. These are my roots.
Not the biological family, but the your
an intellectual family. The intellect has genetic roots.
That the intellect has genetic roots?
Yeah. I just made it up. what I mean is that there are intellectual connections that we feel are true for us. It's an old medieval saying that every person is either Platonic or Aristotelian. And in the same sense, I think you could say that every person is Flaubertian or Balzacian. Every person is either Goethe or Büchner. Every person is, I don't know, Schiller or Trakl. It doesn't mean that a good reader won't appreciate the merits of the other, but that feeling that you are at home in this page, that doesn't happen with every book. And I think that there is an intellectual connection that makes it easier for you to think along the lines of a certain page and not along the lines of another. You know, I have never understood Wittgenstein's dictum about that which you cannot speak, you must remain silent, because I don't know what he means by that which you can't speak. What is it that we can't speak about? The notion that we cannot speak about the metaphysical, to me, sounds absurd, because the metaphysical only exists because we express it in words. So, I mean, I'm not putting myself in a position to discuss with Wittgenstein. I'm simply saying that I don't understand what he means.
You can only understand this when you're Viennese.
Uh-huh. Coming back to Borges, was there also such a connection with you and Borges when you were the reader of Borges? Can you tell us about your relationship with Borges?
Yes, of course. I can tell you. I was working in an English-German bookstore in Buenos Aires. I went to high school, which functioned in the afternoon. So I went to the bookstore, worked in the bookstore in the morning, went to high school, then went back to the bookstore in the evening because I needed some pocket money. And I liked working with books. And I was about 15, 16 at the time. And Borges would come and buy books at this bookstore. Now, Borges had become blind in the mid-50s, and this was taking place in the mid-60s, so he had been blind for about 10 years. And at this point, Borges was trying to do two things. He was trying to study Anglo-Saxon, and his mother would get very impatient. His mother was 90 years old. She would get very impatient and say, Georgie, I don't know why you don't study something useful like Latin or Greek. But he persisted and would buy Anglo-Saxon books. And also, secretly, he was trying to write fiction again. Because when he became blind, he said to himself, now I will only write poetry, because I can compose the poetry in my head and dictate it, especially Borges's poetry, which is very rhythmical and most of it rhymes, so ya no es mágico el mundo, te han dejado, ya no compartirás la clara luna ni los lentos jardines, ya no hay una luna que no sea
espejo del pasado, cristal de soledad, so, and so on.
Difficult to translate, sorry. So fast.
No, it's a shame.
Heavy task.
But, well, what the example I was saying is because it's so musical. He could compose. In fact, he said he composed his poetry by first hearing a music in his head, and then putting words to that music, and then he could dictate this. So he would not write prose again. But when I met him,
he was this time 55. No,
in 65 when I met him, he was 66.
66.
He was born 1 year before the century.
1899.
So at that point, he decided that before he would write fiction, he would revisit the stories by the writers he considered great. He wanted to see, like a mechanic looking at how something has been built, how Stevenson and Henry James and Kipling and so on wrote their stories. So he would ask people to come and read to him. I was one of many. And so he asked me if I had nothing to do in the evenings, if I could come and read to him. So I would go to his house, and he would say, shall we read Kipling tonight? And he would tell me what story to read. And it wasn't reading in the sense of, if I say to you, I'm going to read you something I like and I read it to you. It was really an exercise in analysis of the text from the point of view of a writer. He wanted to see how it was done. So I would start to read, and after two sentences he would interrupt, and he would say, ah, this word, now it will come back two sentences later, but in a different context, and it's interesting that he should open with this, and now he's going to use his tone, and so on. So it was, they were commentaries for himself, which he in fact used afterwards for the book of stories that he published immediately afterwards, which was Dr. Brodie's Report. And then after it's the Book of Sand. So that was the exercise of reading to Borges. So very, very different from reading out loud, in the sense that we mean reading out loud, if I were to stand up here and read to you or read to you.
And how, why did he ask you?
And he asked everybody. He asked the mailman, he asked the porter, he asked the maid.
What a privilege.
Absolutely, a great privilege, but not because of anything I was or could do. I mean, he, I suppose, had a vague notion of who I was, but, you know, I was an adolescent, and there was no dialogue either with him. Borges wasn't interested in having... I did go to dinner with him, and sometimes I would go to the movies with him, because he loved movies, even if he couldn't see them.
Wow.
So you'd have to see, and he didn't want you to tell him exactly the story, so you would have to do things like say, oh, how interesting, this person coming into the door now, and oh, how surprising, it's a cousin, so, and give him the whole story. I think somebody wants to ask a question.
Can I ask you, how long would these sessions last?
The reading sessions lasted about, I would go there about 8 o'clock, and it would be about midnight. We would stop and have something to eat somewhere. It would be about that.
So about 4 hours.
About three, four hours. I was very young and had a lot of energy then, and he always had an enormous amount of energy. It's incredible the amount of energy that man had. He could be for a whole day thinking and talking and would never get tired. It was really extraordinary.
And did you also learn to analyze? Was that something? How did this experience change your way of reading?
I don't know that it changed my way of reading. No, I think what it did, I had been reading for a very long time. It introduced me to some writers that I didn't know, that became my writers too. It showed me how important it is for somebody who wants to write to be able to read well. Today, for instance, when you have a zillion writing workshops and writing courses and so on, I always think this is something completely absurd. There is no way you can teach anybody to write. All you can do is suggest things to read. And this is what Borges was doing for himself. I also, I suppose, learned how logical, how precise the act of reading can be and the commentary of reading can be. I said earlier that it boils down to I like it or I don't like it. But once you have said that, to be able to disentangle in a text what a good construction is and what a bad construction is, what the ability to create a certain tension, what the ability to create beauty with language is, this is something that Borges was able to identify. Maybe that is what I learned, because now, certainly, when I come across a text that I don't like and other people praise, I'm always curious to see how they will defend the text with the text. Not just, oh, he's wonderful, such a great writer, and so on. Fine. Now, let's find a page and show me on the page how this is and what you like and what evokes something for you or makes music or has a balance. What is it? And so many times you realize that the enthusiasm or the lack of enthusiasm has nothing to do with the text. It comes from somewhere outside. It's a social or commercial or some other influence, but not the words on the text. Borges could be implacable, implacable. There was not a single writer, with the exception of Dante maybe, and even there, that Borges would not judge severely. And even being able to say, of course he admired Shakespeare and had wonderful examples of Shakespeare at its best, but then he would say, but now look at this, look how badly this is written. Look how absurd. There is a moment in Hamlet when Hamlet finally realizes that the murderer of his father is Claudius. Of all the words in the English language, Hamlet says, oh, my uncle, uncle. I mean, the tragedy is not that it's his uncle. The tragedy is that it's the man who's sleeping with his mother. It's the man who is his father's brother. That is the tragedy. His uncle. So, and he would do this with many. I won't begin to tell you what he would say about Goethe.
No, please do so.
Yeah, tell us.
Well, he thought that, to begin with, that the conversations with Eckermann were the conversations of an idiot with an idiot. He said there's not one intelligent idea in those conversations. And once again, I heard him say this to somebody who loved Goethe, who said, ah, and Borges said, fine, look, here are the conversations. Now you find me the lines that you think are brilliant and intelligent. And he mainly blamed Eckermann. He said, Eckermann is, I mean, maybe if Goethe would have had someone like Boswell, we would have had something more interesting, more alive, and so on. But he found the whole of the second Faust idiotic and so many things. But he liked the Roman elegies, surprisingly, because it's not what you normally choose. He thought the Elective Affinities was an absurd soap opera. You learn to disagree with him, and for instance, I do like the Elective Affinities very much, but he had his arguments, and they were always concrete. They were never something superficial.
And I think also Borges said that he sees himself more than a reader than a writer. How do you interpret it for yourself?
Well,
do you see yourself more than...
Certainly do, yeah.
As a reader?
I've said that if somebody said I could never write again, I wouldn't care as much as if somebody said I could never read again. I mean, in fact, I think I would be very, very happy if I could just earn my living just reading, sitting at home and not doing anything else. But for Borges, it was... He really understood that reading was the core of literature. When I wrote A History of Reading, what I was trying to do, based perhaps on conversations with Borges or listening to Borges around the idea of the reader, to try and understand what it is that we do when we read. And I realized that one of the surprising things that we readers have to live with is the fact that when we say literature, when we talk about the history of literature, what do? We enumerate writers, we put them in chronological order, we imagine schools, we talk about their work, but who decides this? Who decides what writers are going to be remembered and which are not? Who decides that we recognize a school here but not a school there? Who chooses the works that we call classics? We do, the readers. And we choose them with no recourse from the writer. If you ask any writer, every writer will tell you, of course, I want my work to be remembered. I want it to be a masterpiece. I want to be the best writer ever. And we readers pay no attention to this, but none. A writer can say, look, I sacrificed all my life to write this book, and I'm dying from having written this book, and you must choose me, and we don't. We don't. We don't care at all about that. For all we know, Shakespeare was a horrible person. He was this real estate tax collector and who exploited his daughter, and all he left his wife was his second best bed in his will. We don't care. We have chosen him. And then you probably have someone writing in Shakespeare's time with much more effort and a much nicer person, and it's disappeared. We haven't chosen that person. It's very strange, because we have this enormous unrecognized power. We are the ones who define what is literature. We decide. There's no one else. We decide it through generations, but we decide. And not only we decide, but we even decide what the book is. Jonathan Swift writes Gulliver's Travels as a fierce social satire. We put it in the children's books collection. He would be horrified. There's nothing he can do. The power is ours.
But do you think, what you speak about an ideal reader, if you talk that...
The ideal reader?
Yes, if you say the reader decides, I think in the situation of now, there is the market, there are economic structures who define what people mm-hmm. have to read, mm-hmm. what they do not have to read. I know you work in a bookstore, so you can tell us how the market, I think.
Yeah. Of course.
The market is a very... I don't know if that was...
There were always outside influences of some sort, but never to the point of now. Very, very strong, and it definitely is the market. Definitely. The market is the one that creates the bestseller lists, the market is the one who decides the books that will be sold. But let me ask you a question. Which of the writers on, say, the bestseller list of 2 years ago do you remember?
They disappear normally, the bestseller. With 2 years. Or not?
Yes. Those are writers who will not be remembered, who will not... you can always guarantee that. You know, there are writers who, throughout the history of literature have sold many copies for whatever reason at the time. But eventually it decants, and writers decide what will be held and what won't be. And it does not then have to do with the economic reasons that belong to the past. There are hundreds and thousands of copies of... Well, Alejandro was telling me he was in North Korea, and that every hotel had a shop, and they sold two authors and thousands of copies.
Only
of
two.
Those authors. In spite of those millions and millions of copies, no one's going to remember them in a few years' time. It is curious, but there is really a phenomenon of decanting, and that goes on for generations and generations, and it is really narrowing down so that eventually, from this pool of... First you have all the writers who write. From that pool of writers who write, you have many who are chosen by the commercial structures, and a few who write, who are real writers, who filter through. And slowly the thing decants and decants and decants, and eventually you only have those two, three writers who are worth remembering. It's strange. I don't know exactly what the mechanics are, but we have the proof. The writers that we call classics are classics. I mean, they're no one has yet disproved the importance of Shakespeare or Dante.
And this example, I think it's from Schopenhauer, right? Or not? Because in Parerga, Parapolimena, from Schopenhauer, yes. He describes also with this...
I agree with Schopenhauer.
That only very few, one in a century maybe, or two...
Yes, absolutely. It's a curious phenomenon, but I think it ultimately is the proof of the biological need for intelligence. I really think there is a biological need for intelligence, that stupidity does not allow us to survive, and that curiously we live in societies that have to teach us stupidity in order to sustain that society. But every generation starts again being intelligent and then becoming more and more stupid. But essentially, that intrinsic intelligence still is of importance, of essential importance.
Are there any questions? No?
Years later, I read it and said, this is the book I was looking for.
Of course. Books are very patient. They will wait for you for a very, very long time. And the time of a book is not the time of the advertisement for the book. We are taught now that books have a sell-by date, like eggs. And booksellers know this. You receive all these books, and then you have to sell them because next week you get the new books. And if you go now into a bookstore and you say, you know, I want such and such a book, oh, but that was a book that was published 2 weeks ago, in which case you don't dare ask for Homer, for instance. But I think you're absolutely right. Our relationship with the time of reading is of the essence. And we have to remember that also when we choose the support of the book that we read. For instance, the electronic media requires a time that is not the time of the printed book. We get here in the question of time, we get into a very complicated question, because first of all, human time is not cosmic time. We have a sense of time with its past, present, becoming past, and future that will be present that is a structure of the human brain. It is not a reality of the universe. Yes?
I didn't want to know. Please finish your point.
So it's important to remember that in terms of the universe is such a thing as time-space, which is something completely different, in which the notion of our notion of past, present, and future has absolutely no sense. So when we read, we apply this notion to our sense of narrative, to the book that we expect will have this past, present, and future, and we bring it to the book. A book is all present or all past, if you will, but it does not contain a sequence of time. We bring that sequence of time. The best person the person that has described this best is Saint Augustine. Saint Augustine, in a passage of the Confessions, speaks of reading a psalm, and he says, when you read a psalm that you know, you advance towards or within the territory of what you're going to read, and as you advance, what you read becomes part of the territory of the past. And the more you read, the larger the territory of the past, the territory of memory becomes, and the shorter, the smaller the territory of what lies in that supposed future, until you reach the end of the book, and then everything is past memory. And he says then, this, which happens with the whole psalm, happens with each paragraph, happens with each sentence, happens with each word, with each letter, and happens, and then he goes to the big picture, happens with the life, human life, and happens with each part of human life, and which with each individual life. So the sense that we bring to reading is the sense that we have of living, that we advance towards something that then becomes ours as we exceed it. There is a beautiful image for this that is given by the Venerable Bede. This is such a beautiful image. He says that our life, just to indicate the speed with which this happens, he says human life is like a bird in a storm that enters a lit room from one end and flies out of the other into the storm. And that brief moment in the lit room, that is our life, and this is what we bring to the act of reading. But in itself, a book holds it all there. It has the beginning, the first page, and the last page, and the middle, all in one. Only that is not how we can read.
I was just thinking of led to think when you were talking about who forms, who determines the canon. How long it'll last, once it's determined, or when it will fall apart, or whatever. It just so happens that the Swiss publisher, Kael, the Organist publishing house, just died a couple of weeks ago, I think. And so he, of course, had a particular nose for picking good writers. How long they will last, we don't know. But his other value that's been recognized is that he published in his program some of these, what Hester would call the immortals. And so what do my simple question is, what do you make of these type of persons who obviously have a role to play in this determination of a canon?
Certainly. Yeah. I wouldn't say I don't like the word canon because it implies something rigid. Canon is what was established by the librarians of Alexandria in order to facilitate the work of readers who needed to know, I'm going to read Greek philosophy, what should I read? I can't read everything, so they would make an annotated selection, and that became the canon. But that canon constantly changes because our reading habits change.
It is, however, interesting that there are certain readers who are keener than others. The French have a wonderful word for it called passeur. Passeur is someone who passes on something, who is able to discover something and pass it on. And much of what we call the best literature comes into being that way. I was saying before how books are patient, and they're patient in that sense as well. Someone writes, nobody reads him for the longest time, and then someone like your publisher discovers him and says, oh, you know, here's someone we should bring out again. And it can fail a number of times. It happened, for instance, with Berbarova in France. She had been published in Russian, nobody read her, a few exiles. She was translated into French, a bad translation, nobody read her. And then suddenly, through the publisher Hubert Nissen, he thought, I'm going to read this translation. It's a bad translation, but I think it's a good book. And he had it retranslated, and then suddenly she became famous throughout the world. The same happened with what's his name? The Hungarian who committed suicide in Los Angeles, Embers. Now the name escapes me. Embers, Le Perez. Well, anyway, the name will come back to me. And so on. The names have to wait a long time to be rediscovered. In England, one of the great metaphysical poets, Thomas Traherne, writing in the 17th century, was discovered because in the early 20th century, a bookseller found a pile of manuscripts in a garbage bag, pail. And it happened to be the poems of Traherne, and he was recognized as this incredible writer. The poems of Catullus were discovered in the Renaissance in one single copy. I mean, we wouldn't have Catullus unless we had this one copy. And so it happens. And people like your publisher are those enlightened beings who say, here is something that we must preserve.
In the age of internet and so on, I know you don't have a cell phone, you don't have internet at home.
I don't drive.
You don't drive, etc.
I don't drink Coca-Cola.
You don't drink Coca-Cola, that we know that. You think the book is being questioned now because of the electronic books, the e-books and so on. Mm. How do you see the future for the book?
Well, that I don't know, but... I think it's a very good thing that we have started asking questions about the book. When I wrote, I'm sorry to quote myself, but when I wrote The History of Reading 15 years ago, nobody was writing about the reading, about the reader, about the act of reading. There were a few things, but mainly theoretical. There wasn't a question there. Now every other book is about reading. And I think this is something that a new technology always does. The new technology appears and announces the death of the previous technology. This is what happened, for instance, photography was invented, this is the death of painting. Then what happens is that the new technology borrows the vocabulary of the old technology, as with photography, doing still lives and portraits and so on. The old technology doesn't die, but borrows elements from the new technology, and they both advance together, fed by one another. And what happens when the new technology comes into being is that people realize that there was an old technology, that what they took just as something that was there was in fact an old technology, was a technology that seems threatened, and begin to want to know more. So, for instance, when the printing press was invented and manuscripts seemed to be threatened, people wanted to learn how to do calligraphy, and one of the best sellers of the time immediately after the incunabula, but even some incunabula, are writing manuals, manuals of calligraphy, because once there is some other way of writing, people wanted to know, well, but how do we do this other thing? And so to